Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of F This Movie, the podcast about F's and movies.
Da 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 da. Da 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 da. This is the scary one.
With me tonight
dun, dun.
Is a very special guest. Lon Chaney Jr. Ladies and gentlemen, Lon Chaney Jr.
Hello, I'm a lunkhead, and apparently I'm an alcoholic, and I like nothing better than to retire to my trailer with Broderick Crawford, and we tie one on, and then we beat the crap out of each other. At least that's what I've read.
This is maybe
I'm a lunkhead.
Our ninth or tenth show, and that is the first reference both to lunkhead and Broderick Crawford.
We will return to lunkhead.
With me tonight is John.
Hello.
Who is a movie expert, a horror movie expert, which is particularly appropriate because tonight the movie we are discussing is
The Wolfman.
The 2010 remake, directed by Joe Johnston, sort of The Wolfman, which came out earlier this year and quickly disappeared. But before we talk about that, I always have to ask this question. JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, there's a movie theater in Chicago called The Music Box that shows Repertory, and last Sunday I saw The Killer Inside Me with my son, which I thought was good. It seemed to be an honest attempt at doing Jim Thompson. Or is that Jim McBride?
Jim McBride.
Directed. The remake of Breathless.
Correct.
So it's Jim Thompson.
Right.
I'm an expert, ladies and gentlemen, but I'm getting very old. And that was worth seeing for Casey Affleck's performance, but the minute you see it, you'll see why it didn't get a wider release. And then the week before, we went to see the reissue of Breathless.
Not directed by Jim McBride.
No, the original version by Jean-Luc Godard, which is still very impressive for some of the formalistic things that he brought to
That's
the cinema.
That's the opposite of what you were trying to say.
Very worthwhile to see just for the editing.
Can I make a confession? I actually like the Jim McBride remake of Breathless.
There are some things to like in the McBride remake. I haven't seen it in a dog's age, but my memory is that I really liked the use of music in the remake.
Yeah, it's good, with the exception of the lead actress,
Valerie Kaprisky,
right, who was just a college student, right,
and who is now residing in the Where Are They Now file.
Yeah, that was her only movie, right?
I believe she made some sort of semi-Cinemax after Hours Fair and then sort of disappeared.
It's kind of pointless after Breathless because she gave away the full Spano in Breathless. I saw Toy Story 3, which was good, and which I won't say that much about except that it was probably my least favorite of the Toy Stories. Even though it's still really great, I just felt like a lot of what it did well had already been done, particularly in Toy Story 2.
Which is always a problem with sequels, and I know I always tell my students, clue number one as to his secret identity, I always tell my students that you should never go to see sequels, that given the odds, you're not missing anything. It's a waste of your time. You can count the good ones on one hand. And I have a particular bias against Toy Story 2 as the antagonist, as the villain in that piece, looks exactly like me. Very, very disturbing, that film.
Do you like Toy Story 2?
Yeah, in that, like most Pixar films, it's not just fart jokes. When I go see a Pixar film, it's full of trailers for other films aimed at children.
Yeah.
And it's just 20 minutes of what parent would possibly take their kids to this pee and fart fest, which seems to be what the trailers are full of to get an easy laugh.
Right.
So in the spirit of Ratatouille, which I thought had this really nice subtle message that I want kids to get, the whole thing in Toy Story, that toys are meant to be played with, they're not investments, they're not your retirement plan, and the reason why Stinky Pete was awful is that he had never been played with, which I thought was just delightful, and shows that they're willing to put sort of a little bit more intellectual content into the films, perhaps for parents.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I remember taking my son to go see children's films, and frequently I would fall asleep because right. there was nothing there for me.
Which is what most of, like you said, the trailers before the Pixar movies.
Oh.
Right.
If Pixar had any control over that, they should be much more careful about what... Oh, God, it's just farm animals and just like an idiot's idea of how to copy them.
They all have the exact same beats, and we saw three or four of them before Toy Story that could have been for the same movie. And it's depressing because I have a very young son who I will want to take to the movies, and your choices are limited when your child is very young, and so I feel like we will end up seeing some of those movies, and I wish we had better choices.
Oh, you will. But occasionally there'll be a diamond in the rough. I remember my son's first movie was going to be Beauty and the Beast. Great first movie, mm-hmm. but the stuff in the woods at the beginning, specifically the music, scared him.
Yeah.
So, like more parents should do, we took him out.
Yeah.
We went home. He's not ready for this. So my son's first movie wound up being Fern Gully
yeah.
for The Last Rainforest,
yeah.
which was not only entertaining, and he really dug it as a kid, but because I saw that many years later, I didn't have to see Avatar.
I so wished that my son was a little bit older because I really wanted Toy Story 3 to be his first movie because it's great and it's Pixar. And he already likes Woody and Buzz. He kind of responds to them. But seeing the movie, I'm so glad we didn't even attempt it because
yeah.
there's stuff in there that's, I think, too intense for a five-year-old, let alone a kid that's under two.
I was really thinking, and I was just going to suggest this, that perhaps his first movie could be the remake of The Wolfman.
I had to wait till he went to sleep to watch this. The little short film, Pixar always puts the little short films before their movies, is great. It's called Night and Day. Not to be confused with the Tom Cruise Night and Day.
Oh, yeah, good lord.
Which is also known as Bird on a Wire. So let's talk about The Wolfman. And we're in a very appropriate setting to discuss The Wolfman, because we're here in JB's basement, surrounded by... I don't know how many hundreds of who makes these Sideshow
McFarlane? All sorts of it's a room full of monsters, and it's a pathetic middle-aged man's attempt, semi-successful attempt though, to recreate his childhood and to exert mastery over the things that used to frighten him.
And they're in chronological order, correct?
Well, because if you didn't arrange all of the figures in the order the films were released, how could you sleep at night? I believe Doug, our mutual friend, used to describe this place as a little museum.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say, there are life-size heads, busts, if you will, of Nosferatu and the creature from the Black Lagoon staring at us as we attempt to do this podcast.
Yeah. It's given me the heebie-jeebies.
Now, there's a phrase you don't hear very much anymore.
I'm bringing it back. Lunkhead and heebie-jeebies.
Well, we're going to return to Lunkhead.
Okay.
Now, here's my question. I deliberately didn't ask this until he flipped the switch on this magical device. Did you like the remake? I do not know the answer to this question. Did you like the remake of The Wolfman?
Funny you should ask. I like things about the remake of The Wolfman. I don't think I like it overall, but I get the suspicion that you do.
Yes. And when I first saw it in a theater, there was something. Are we allowed to do spoiler alert?
Spoilers for The Wolfman, everybody. He turns into a wolf.
Well, not just one.
Oh, right. Yeah, real spoilers for The Wolfman.
Yeah, there's going to be spoilers galore, so shut it off if you haven't seen this film. That... There's something that happens at the end, which I thought was just so demented. It sort of ruined the evening for me because it was so odd and misplaced and spoke to multiple reshoots
right.
and studio heads giving notes that, of course, make no sense because they don't know anything about classic horror films, that I sort of let that color my experience. So I sat down and watched it again on Blu-ray. To prepare for this podcast, and I was really surprised that the part that is very problematic for me is incredibly short. If you gave me this film to re-edit,
mm-hmm.
I actually found the join where you could take it out. You could take it out and no one would know, and it would be a much better film. So that being said, when I watched it again, I loved the hell out of this movie.
Really?
I thought, really? Even though at times it seems like a commercial for a new Universal Studios attraction, that they would build that village and you could walk through it and have a Diet Coke and then someone would show up like the Wolfman. I think there's a lot more to like in this film than there is to dislike, and especially if you're into the classic Universal monster films, which of course I am. It's delightful, and I think it's nitpicking that keep people from enjoying it more. There's no way that they're going to release a film that's going to please you in the way that the Universal films from the 30s and early 40s did, and I think for some people that's a wall,
okay,
that keeps them from enjoying this for what it has and what it does right.
Okay. I can enjoy the... I think you're right about that. I don't know that my... The problems that I had with it weren't necessarily because I was comparing it to the original Universal monster movies. There's definitely a lot of things I like about it, starting with the fact that I think it's a horror movie, and a pretty hardcore horror movie that seems targeted at adults, which we rarely get anymore.
Which I didn't think about, but you're right. I don't, for a number of reasons, I don't see what children could get out of this, right, as opposed to more recent sort of remakes of 70s horror films, right, which seem very definitely to be targeted,
absolutely, towards teenagers. Right. I just think, to borrow a joke that I think it's Doug Benson's joke, after he saw Funny People, he said, I saw a couple movies this weekend. They were called Funny People. And that's sort of how I feel about The Wolfman, that there's things in there that I really like constantly clashing, sometimes in the span of a single scene, with things that don't work at all. And this is such a stupid, like you said, possibly nitpicky thing, but something that jumps out at me right away is every once in a while, Joe Johnston cuts to an obvious CGI or green screen shot, and we can get into the whole CGI transformation issue, but the shots of him running, those close-up shots of him running, those are from another movie. I don't understand. It's just this weird inconsistency in tone when it's sort of somber and stately and very moody, and it does that really well. It's great. And then it goes crazy, and he's in an asylum, and there's close-up shots of him running, and that scene at the end that you're talking about. None of that works for me.
It speaks to a very troubled production, and watching it again, and now we add a layer of difficulty to this because the Blu-ray is the extended cut.
Right.
And I'm watching it, and I'm trying to remember, yeah, how it's different than the theatrical
cut. With the exception of the Max von Sydow scene, I couldn't pick it out.
And it seems to me that the scene that we're talking about is when Del Toro is on the train going back home to investigate the murder of his brother. A rather mysterious figure is in the train car with him, and it's Max von Sydow, and he gives Lawrence the cane. In the theatrical version, in the absence of that scene, does Lawrence just show up with it?
I guess,
like,
yeah.
I'm prepared,
right,
for this ironic use of a prop.
Him getting it make the movie any better?
But it's nice to see Max von Sydow getting work.
Sure.
And
he was in Shutter Island.
I thought, no, that's true. And it was nice to see him. What I questioned was, I began to question if the theatrical version had the scene of him playing Hamlet on stage.
I don't think it did.
No, okay. That was new. And
it was,
and
sort of more of a montage, I think. It was part of a montage.
Right. And that doesn't work at all, because if you're not a fan of Benicio del Toro, watching him in a movie pretend to be a Shakespearean actor, and we only hear a couple lines. I'm no expert on Shakespeare, but you can see why they cut that out. That in the extended cut, the girlfriend comes backstage and implores him to come home, right, and investigate this murder.
Right.
And that was not in the theatrical cut, because then for the rest of the DVD, they keep making reference to this letter. Right. She sent a letter.
Right.
And if you're sitting there trying to make sense of it, you're thinking, Did she bring him a letter backstage?
She read it aloud.
Is it a metaphoric letter? So there are several moments in the film where you can see the join. And the other thing that is along the same lines that I caught was there's something really weird going on with Anthony Hopkins' hair.
You picked up on this when you saw it in the theater.
Unless they were trying for when he's kind of scowly, his hair is messy.
Spoilers.
And then the spoilers are coming, gang. And then when he's obviously not scowly, he's a little bit more put together,
right,
and his hair is slicked back.
Right.
But the makeup on his face is different in the scenes where his hair is perfectly coiffed. And not to keep teasing with this, the film desperately wants to present this sort of father-son, sins of the fathers theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all for that because I'm a sucker for movies that involve fathers and sons. But basically, it's revealed that the original werewolf that killed the brother is the father.
Right.
That Anthony Hopkins is, in fact, a wolf man.
And mom, right.
Yeah, and he also killed his wife. And that doesn't work on a magnitude that I can't express. Because if you take that out, if you take out that the father, and again, the original Universal film didn't need to add that gloss.
Right.
Claude Rains, who was the original father, found a way to do it as this very distant, skeptical voice.
Mm-hmm.
Not this, ha-ha, no one knows my secret voice. So at the end of the film, Hopkins turns into a wolfman, and Benicio del Toro turns into a wolfman, and they fight for 5 minutes. In the movie theater, it seemed like a lot longer.
Yeah.
And at that point, when we have CGI fighting CGI, much like at the end of Iron Man, to me it becomes a video game,
right,
and it's very uninteresting.
Right.
But if you were to take that out, you get a very interesting film that doesn't need that little plot complication. And a film that I really liked because of the way that it looked,
mm-hmm,
the sets,
mm-hmm,
the costumes,
yeah,
the cinematography, the, yep, lighting.
Yep.
It's like I'm in Universal Monsterland,
yeah,
and I'll gladly spend 2 hours there.
This is definitely too nitpicky, but there are certain shots where I feel it's just a little too artificial. And I know artifice was sort of the point, but there are times where it feels very much rendered in a computer.
Very definitely.
Yeah.
That sort of computery look. Terry Gilliam once said the reason he doesn't like CGI and the fact that he likes to use miniature work is that when you're watching CGI, you are looking at the work of one person or what the computer can do. Whereas if you're looking at a miniature that was actually manufactured, there's an infinite number of ways that real light will hit a,
right,
real object.
Right.
And your eye can tell the difference.
Yeah.
Because when you're looking at CGI, it's the way that the computer determines that the light will hit the object,
mm-hmm,
and it's just not the same.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the stuff that they did, some of the makeups, a lot of the sets,
yeah,
I thought were physical objects.
Yeah, definitely.
That it made me very happy to sit there for 2 hours and pretend to live in that town.
My theory on the Anthony Hopkins thing, and maybe I'm wrong about this, because definitely there's a like you said, a thematic tie-in about fathers and sons, but it almost feels like somebody at the studio was uncomfortable with this movie where the villain is the main character. Even though he's a tragic character, that they needed some sort of external bad guy for him to fight and defeat.
And that never occurred to me, but you are so right,
yeah,
because the basic tenets of a Shakespearean tragedy, which this is,
right,
every good version is, would escape a studio head who cannot fathom that the protagonist and the antagonist can be the same,
right,
character.
Right.
Perfect sense why they would want to add that.
Though I do appreciate that it doesn't back down from the horrible things that Lawrence himself does, that they don't try and soften him, you know, particularly as when he's in full wolfman mode, he does some nasty shit.
True. Although on that score, I thought, and I've noticed this about a lot of recent horror films, It seems like the director could have expanded his bag of tricks somewhat in that modern horror films love to use very loud sounds to scare you.
Right.
And in this case, it was usually the Wolfman's sudden growl.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the extent of having the Wolfman occasionally turn his head very quickly. And that was the thing that was meant to startle you.
Right.
And I believe you can see this in the Gypsy Camp scene, which except for this one little nitpick, I actually thought was a very exciting scene, that it's where is he going to pop up?
Right.
That's the game.
Right.
And all three things that I'm talking about, the jump cuts, the sudden loud noises, and the pop-up whack-a-mole Wolfman, seem to be pretty elementary in that there's other ways to scare people. It's just a lot harder to do that.
Right. Speaking of sort of the killing and the gore in the movie, which is pretty hardcore, there's times where I thought it really works, and particularly because the movie is so sort of gray and muted and the blood has this particular color and it looks almost like an old Hammer movie. But at times I feel like the degree to which they really go for the gore is, again, at odds with the movie that he's trying to make, that it's... Well, there's something that feels too contemporary about the level of gore.
It goes along with what you were saying, that clearly this is for adults.
Right.
But, again, you're saying all these things tonight that I really agree with, that in terms of how beautiful, in a very weird sense of the word beautiful, in terms of how beautiful a lot of the film is, in terms of it establishing atmosphere and being very atmospheric, the blood does get in the way. And something about me tells me I should feel guilty about liking this. But I remember, and I think I've seen it three times, there's a scene where the Wolfman performs a very overt act of violence on a character, and basically we see an arm fly through the air, land on the ground, the hand is clutching a gun,
right,
and shorn of its body, the hand discharges
right,
the weapon.
Right.
That's one of the things we go to see horror films
for. No, I know. I agree. But then, like I said, it just at times feels like... It almost feels like pandering to that at times, when it goes a little too far. The one that really sticks out of my head is, I think, the claw through the mouth.
Yes.
That one just feels like... It's all gratuitous. I get that. But that one in particular was...
And I had the same reaction...
About designing kills.
You know? I had the same reaction when I watched it again that... It seemed as if the director were trying, and I think he succeeded, at establishing or trying to establish Victorian manners about many things,
mm-hmm.
because it's such a wonderful dichotomy to this man becoming a beast and doing all these socially unacceptable things. So how interesting that this Wolfman is set much earlier in time than the 1940s version. And all of the things about manners, when the girlfriend comes backstage, she's told that this is a private party. And when Benicio del Toro wants to talk to her later at his father's castle, he sort of tells her lady-in-waiting, her little maid, mm-hmm. may I have a word with? And he thanks her for prolonging her stay. All of these... things that back then it was so very difficult to be direct about anything,
mm-hmm.
and that the Wolfman is sort of seeing that Victorian pretense ripped to shreds, mm-hmm. and seeing this beast come out. I thought that worked really well, and that maybe that was enough to make their point rather than us going from Victorian, oh, excuse me, sir, to a claw
right.
Through your chin.
Right. Joe Johnston, who directed the movie, was not the original director on the movie. The original director was a guy named Mark Romanek, who's only made a handful of movies, all of which were okay. I think he was a video director and then made a handful of movies, and he walked off the project. I don't totally know why, but he's the one who made some of the initial decisions, including hiring Benicio del Toro, and he was part of designing the makeup, hiring Rick Baker, who then... They ended up scrapping a lot of the work he did.
Yeah.
And
it was actually Rick Baker who posted some pictures a long time ago of what the creature concept was going to be like
right.
that started to get really hardcore old school Universal fans excited. I know he posted two pictures to the Classic Horror Film Board, and everyone was like, oh my God, this is going to be the must-see movie.
Well, it's a great makeup. Like, I really like the actual Wolfman makeup on Benicio del Toro. I'm not as crazy about the Anthony Hopkins Wolfman makeup, but...
Well, that one sort of made me laugh. It was a little grayer.
Rick Baker left and then came back, and Danny Elfman did a score, and then they tossed that, and then he was back on about 2 weeks before the movie came out. The movie had several release dates, and finally was released, I think, Valentine's Day weekend of this year, because that's when everyone wants to go see
people the getting Wolfman. Ripped apart.
And I feel like when the movie came out, the reviews were sort of middle of the road. I think people were giving it a lot of credit. It's interesting, too. This is the second Joe Johnston movie that we've done on F This Movie. He's the first director to get two movies. You know, great filmmaker Joe Johnston. I think people were giving it a lot of credit for not being as bad as it could have been, considering...
Oh, I know I did.
...the production.
I went expecting troubles. A mess, yeah. And I didn't get a mess. You mentioned Del Toro, and this takes us back to Lunkhead, which I promised we would return to. As I watched it again, it occurred to me... I am kind of a fan of Del Toro. I like him in movies for a number of reasons, both the original skinny Del Toro in The Usual Suspects and then the later amazing Del Toro in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. That as I watched it, I realized that one of the reasons why it works is that Del Toro, for all of the talk of him being a famous Shakespearean actor, is really a lunkhead at the beginning of this.
Right.
And Lon Chaney Jr., and I love Lon Chaney Jr., is a lunkhead at the beginning of the original Wolfman. He's just the classic American lunkhead.
Right.
And in a way, and this is going to sound really pretentious, that Arthur Miller once said what he was doing with Death of a Salesman is taking tragedy down from King Lear and making a common man the subject of tragedy, the tragic hero. And you don't get much commoner than Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah.
or Benicio del Toro.
Yeah.
So Benicio del Toro, good work as a lunkhead.
I like all of the actors in the movie, though I can't say I'm crazy about any of the performances. You know, I like Emily Blunt. She's not given a whole lot to do. Anthony Hopkins is in a different movie. The one I really like in the movie is Hugo Weaving.
Yeah.
I thought he's really great in that movie.
The actress who played the girlfriend?
Emily Blunt.
Right. I'm not really that familiar with her, but... Because the DVD includes three different endings.
Oh, I didn't even watch those.
Oh, pick how depressing you want the ending to be.
Oh,
one of them is just...
What are they?
Oh, my Lord.
Can you talk about what they are?
To the extent that I remember, because they're very close, and in fact, you should watch all three of them, because it shows you how much you can change something with very little editorial work at all. I believe all of them do not cut back to the castle burning.
Okay.
And her saying, if you kill the man or the beast, how do you tell the difference? Which makes no sense.
Right.
What I liked about the alternate endings is, no matter how they end, we go back up into the trees, we see the moon, blackout.
Which is how I thought it was going to end.
And that's...
Watching the movie the first time.
That's the end of this film.
Yeah.
But like every film made for the last 25 years, it has to end... And end
right.
and end
right.
again. So my favorite of the alternate endings, which I would have loved to see how well the film would have done had they included it, is... I'm not sure about the sequence, but basically Benicio kills the girlfriend.
Really?
Fatally.
Really?
He's shot. He dies. We cut to Hugo... Hugo's obviously been bitten,
right.
but he's not dead, so
right.
he's the next Wolfman. Have a great night, folks. The end.
No kidding.
Which, I mean, literally is Shakespearean.
Yeah, right.
You're dead, you're dead, you're fucked. Good night.
And they did two of the three of those, but apparently Emily Blunt has to live in the theatrical version.
And one thing I liked, because...
That's a better ending, though.
I liked her performance, but I didn't think she was given anything to do.
Right.
At the end... She has to look at the Wolfman and talk as if it's Lawrence. And because I watched all three of the alternate endings, I saw that same performance, plus or minus a couple frames through editing, again and again and again. And that's a really nice moment. That's a moment we need more of. You mentioned the performances. I think what really stranded everyone, and this is what was going through my head as I watched it the second time, is most good movies have memorable lines of dialogue.
Right.
In fact, not only was I decrying the absence of Maria Uspenskaya in this film, who played the original Maliva, the gypsy woman, right, although it's nice to see Geraldine Chaplin getting work, is that in the original version, she has this lovely poem that she recites,
right,
over the body of her dead son.
Right.
And I'm wondering why they didn't bring that back, because it's beautiful,
right,
and it's memorable. So I watched the entire film, and I came up with one memorable line. And I'm even wondering if you remember it, because when I saw it in the theater, it struck me, that's pretty good. And then the movie kept going, and I quickly forgot.
Holy shit, I'm a fucking wolfman.
He never says that. Patrick's making that up. At one point, Anthony Hopkins, who I agree is in a different movie, and it's called Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, right.
Where... Right. When we need the old kook, we import him in. Ever since he played Hannibal, he specializes in those roles. At one point, they're discussing something which is of no consequence, and Anthony Hopkins looks at his son and says, "The past is a wilderness of horrors."
That is a good line.
And that line just struck me.
Yeah.
But on the other end of the spectrum, it occurred to me that A, some of the dialogue in this film is laughably bad, and if they were so careful to make it look right in terms of the village, and look beautiful in terms of the costumes, someone should have been paid, or maybe they had an intern who can do this, a PA, to go through the script and look for anachronisms. Because considering when the film is set, did people say, "Feel free"? Someone in the film says, "Feel free." I don't think that existed back then. And there's a couple examples of that. But I think my least favorite line of dialogue...
People did say, "It's your funeral." Which is said a lot in this movie, by the way.
It struck me as so awful that I wrote it down, and then I realized that, well, it can't be that awful, because I think there's hundreds of other films that have this line.
Oh, boy.
So here it is. Look for it the next time you watch The Wolfman. I'm not making this up. This is word for word. How many other films have you heard this line in? If anything happened to you, I would never forgive myself.
That's been
in every movie ever made since the dawn of the talk.
And that's Benicio saying that to Emily Blunt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, maybe that's why they cut that alternate ending. Because something does happen to her, and he can't forgive himself because he dies.
Spoiler. I thought it was interesting what they left out from the original. The weird little cartilage that remains from the original. In the original, Gwen runs some sort of antique shop with her father. And even though it has nothing to do with the film and nothing to do with the plot, when Lawrence winds up in London, he hides out in the family antique shop. And we see it, and I guess the scriptwriter was sitting there, well, he goes somewhere. And wait. Oh, in the original film, okay, make it an antique shop. It just comes off as very curiously offhand.
Right.
Or, again, a little shout-out for people who have warm memories of the original.
And I'll bet that's what it is, honestly, more than anything, to the extent where that they're actually congratulating themselves for including that. It's a little Easter egg for the fans. Well, no, that's...
Well, the real Easter egg, which they spoiled by putting it in the commercial, and I ascribe mercenary motives to that, that by putting it in the commercial, they were telling anyone who was any interest in horror films, hey gang, Rick Baker signed off on this because he was prominently featured in the commercial getting taken out. And it's clearly him, because even though he's in Victorian dress, he has that distinctive beard and that distinctive white hair. I was sort of hoping, and maybe it's too soon, that the DVD would have all sorts of things that explained what happened to this film on the long road of its gestation.
Yeah, I think it's too soon.
I
don't know that we'll ever get a reissue, but that's when it would happen.
Right, the 10th anniversary.
Right.
Now it can be told version with everyone who's still alive. And David Fincher is going to show up on that version, even though he had nothing to do with the film, just because he's still bitter about...
Alien 3.
Alien 3, yeah. That he's going to get his 2 cents in about the Wolfman.
And the screenplay to the Wolfman, co-written by Andrew Kevin Walker, who wrote Seven. And
there's the connection.
Sleepy Hollow,
which I gotta tell you, folks, this Victoria. Patrick gentleman, the connections he makes, my synapses no longer work.
But that was another thing that sort of inspired hope in me, although he hasn't written that many movies. I like Seven. I like Sleepy Hollow. It also is Victorian and very much like a Hammer movie. He also wrote 8mm, which I really hate, so I'll hold that against him.
There's a lot of reasons to hate
that. But that gave me hope. So I don't know if he wrote Feel Free or if that was the other guy. I don't know who the other writer is, but...
Right, and again, there's studio interference all over this film, yeah. And I love Patrick's point about, we need a villain. How about the father?
Well, what
is a Wolfman too?
What purpose?
It's the Wolfman family.
Right. Like...
But on some levels, they're giving you credit for things, but on another level, they're giving you no credit at all, because the last thing I wrote, I took notes, I'm old school, on paper with
He's
a
very
pen.
Prepared.
Me,
nothing. I didn't even see the Wolfman. I watched Wolf.
Oh, God. That's another podcast. Wolf makes the Wolfman look like a masterpiece.
There are things I like in Wolf. I will say that.
There was one thing I like in Wolf.
Jack Nicholson?
When Jack Nicholson pees on the guy.
Oh, yeah.
And says he's marking his territory.
I like the first half of
the
Wolf.
The whole
and
movie
then it becomes
should
a studio note with a villain.
At one point, Emily...
Blunt.
I'll avoid the obvious joke. Emily Blunt is shown doing some research so she can figure out what has happened to Lawrence, whom she now loves. And she's shown looking through a book that has all these pictures and all these answers.
Wolfman book.
And at one point at the top of the page, we can see what the book is called.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is entitled Ancient Gypsy Lore. That is the name of the book, and you can check it out from your local library. And I'm watching the film, and I actually froze the frame so I can read that at the top. And I said, Ancient Gypsy Lore. I want a copy of that book. I need some more lore.
They've collected it all for you. What purpose does the gypsy serve in this movie?
Well, again, because they picked and chose from the original.
Right. There is a gypsy.
Because they need the father to be the villain,
right?
We throw out Bella.
Right.
And Bella's important for a number of reasons. Number one, in the original film, it's Bella Lugosi.
Right.
And explaining the importance of that would take another podcast. But the original Wolfman, in the original Wolfman, is Bella Lugosi, who's a gypsy, who bites Lawrence Talbot when he's trying to fend him off. And Maliva, the gypsy woman, is Bella's mother. So now we have this family dynamic where we have a reason for Maliva to feel the way she does and have tremendous empathy for Lawrence and try to help him. But once you get rid of Bella for whatever reason, and it can't be, oh, people would laugh at gypsies because this remake has plenty of gypsies.
Right.
What I kept waiting for was... And maybe it's because it's in the original film. Geraldine Chaplin is a very famous actress. She's had several really interesting roles in a lot of interesting films, most of them in the 70s. And, of course, she's Charlie Chaplin's daughter, for God's sake. And on the other hand, we have Anthony Hopkins. Why don't they have a scene together?
Yeah.
Because in the original, those two characters do have a scene together,
right.
Which makes sense because in the original film, their attitude is completely opposed.
Right.
The definition of drama, the definition
right.
of conflict.
Right.
The father thinks he's making it all up, that there's a scientific solution, and Maliva, of course, knows the truth.
Right.
So that's where you have that. The minute you make the father the Wolfman...
The bad Wolfman.
The bad Wolfman, not the tragic
because
sad
he likes
one.
Being a Wolfman.
Yeah, and God knows nobody would like that.
It's fucking awesome.
The minute you make the father the bad Wolfman, the only possible scene between the bad Wolfman father and the gypsy woman would be for her to be tremendously scared of him
right.
or to see through him.
Right.
But it would be a very, very different scene
right.
than the interesting scene of confrontation and disdain that those two actors share in the original. And again, maybe I'm just crying into my beer because Maria Uspenskaya, who played the original Maliva, that is one of the most indelible portrayals right. in all of Universal horror films.
Yeah.
In fact, later in her career, she became an acting coach of some renown. And what she brings to that part is just her voice, her manner, her speaking. It's very beautiful in its own way.
When she became an acting coach, though, correct me if I'm wrong, she only taught people how to play gypsies.
Right. And at that point, post-World War II, the gypsy roles were drying
up. They dried
left
up.
And right.
Let's talk about the transformation. Because ultimately, I have to think that's why you make a Wolfman movie now, right?
Yeah, not to be crude, but certainly in the original films, it was done with lap dissolves, and then in the history of the Universal films, you see them getting more and more sophisticated, so that by Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, you get two transformation scenes that are mm-hmm. really quite wonderful to watch. But American Werewolf in London obviously set the standard, and that was Rick Baker. And oh, surprise, it's all physical effects that right. they actually created. My problem with the transformation in The Wolfman, not that it wasn't enjoyable and entertaining to watch, but that at times it grew cartoonish.
Right.
In that,
as all CGI does.
In American Werewolf in London, not only did, I'm guessing it was Landis, suggest that the transformation itself is painful
yeah.
and slow.
Right.
And maybe it's slow because these are foam rubber appliances that they're inflating
right.
from under the stage, but especially in the sanitarium scene, in the insane asylum scene, mm-hmm. Not only is the transformation very cartoony right. and quick,
right.
but I found that scene to be interesting because the head of the insane asylum is so awful and so stupid and so backward and so sadistic mm-hmm. that the film puts us in a position of not only wanting to see him get it,
right.
but to see all those hundreds of doctors get it.
Right.
And again, going back to the original Wolfman, I don't think in the original Wolfman we felt sorry for the gentleman who was forced to do this because of
right.
his fate,
right.
but we were never rooting for the beast
right.
to kill anyone.
Right. Well, but again, that also speaks to the thing that we said about the level of gore, and you had said that's part of why we go see horror movies, and that's absolutely true, but what that does is put us in the position of rooting for the Wolfman because we want to see him tear people up because we like that.
And also on a story level, he didn't do anything wrong to become the Wolfman. In fact, he came back to town to
right.
honestly investigate the death of his brother, whereas the doctors are willfully dunking into
right.
him into ice water
right.
and sticking a needle in his neck.
right.
Well, who do you side with?
Right.
And the film, cleverly and simplistically, gives us two choices.
Right.
I picked the furry guy.
But again, that's why I would say that that alternate ending where Emily Blunt dies works better because now he has killed someone that we care about, that we are invested in, because at no point in this movie he just kills random extras.
I have no problem.
Feel nothing for.
I have no problem with the Emily Blunt character dying. I think, in a way, it gets more to the heart of what the story is about.
Right.
And beyond every horror movie cliche, I'm guessing from Halloween on, the tracking shot to Hugo weaving. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this curse ain't over yet, folks, mm-hmm. I have no problem with either.
No, I don't
it
either.
Is beautiful, and in the land of classic horror films, it's poetic.
Yeah, my problem with the CGI transformation, I guess, is that what's so great about, you know, again, it's unfair, I guess, to compare it to American Werewolf in London, although it isn't, because it's the same guy doing it, and, you know, this movie has the advantage of being almost 30 years later, is that what's so great about American Werewolf in London is, the movie stops to show a guy transform into a wolf, and what's amazing in the audience is that they're actually doing that we're seeing. We know we're being tricked, but it's amazing the way we're being tricked.
And it's a long scene. It's one of the highlights of the film. Not to be coarse, but in a Wolfman movie, the transformation scene is the money shot.
Right.
And ironically, in the remake, one of the other effects of the CGI is to speed it up.
as if an unseen studio executive is saying, pick up the pace, pick up the pace.
But that's exactly what it feels like.
As if we're not going to be entranced watching a man turn into a wolf.
But I'm
They're
not.
Negating the reason a lot of people are going to the movie.
I agree 100% with you, but I think they did that as soon as they made it CGI.
Yes.
Because we know anything is possible with CGI. So we're not impressed. We're not... Nothing that we're seeing is cool. At no point are we sitting there thinking, boy, how did they do this? Or look at what they're showing us. This is unbelievable. Anything is possible with CGI. So I would just assume the movie doesn't stop to show him turn into a wolf. Skip over that beat.
And if because they, it serves no purpose. Never show that,
yeah.
And certainly that would have the added bonus of not showing Anthony Hopkins turn into a wolf man, right. The less said about the better. It would be a very, very different film and might return to the Patrick Bromley edit where there's a lot less gore.
Yeah.
The atmosphere is played up. The transformations are implied. And I would argue a better film, but a film that's will be successful with you and me and right. No one else.
Absolutely. I know that they have to show that because that's why people go, but I just think as soon as you make it CGI, you almost negate the whole reason for showing it. Because you can show anything with CGI. And unless they're coming up with really out there things that happen to his body, which they don't really. I mean, we saw his teeth fall out at one point, yeah?
There's that odd scene in the insane asylum where...
His tongue is flicking?
They show his face a lot, and right. My problem is... And I'm not... I'm certainly not well-versed in CGI, but I think it was conceptualized incorrectly in that between Benicio and the Wolfman, there's this step in between that looks nothing like Benicio
or
and
like
nothing like a Wolfman,
right.
And it's the larval CGI right. Wolfman, and it's an odd-looking little demon head.
Right.
That was unpleasant.
Flicking its tongue. The lighting is very bright. The first transformation scene, I think, is better because we just see it in pieces, right? He's kind
yes.
of walking down that hallway.
Yeah.
And we just see pieces, and that's fine. That works. But that scene in the asylum, and really it's that whole asylum sequence where the movie kind of goes off the rails for me. Everything up to that point is okay. You know, I'm with the movie. And then once he gets to that asylum,
well, again,
it becomes a different movie.
Nothing's going to top... For me, nothing's going to top, in terms of sheer awfulness, Anthony Hopkins as Grandpa Wolfman. But I like the insane asylum scene, if only because it makes very specific what the film should be about, or one of the things the film should be about. We have a group of people who are versed in science mm-hmm. and medicine and rationality and logic. Mm-hmm. And there's no way they can believe this is true.
Right.
And guess what? This is a horror film. And it's true.
Right.
So beyond watching everyone get slashed up and bleeding and getting their comeuppance, it's sort of interesting on a Keystone Cops level to see some stuffed shirts be proved wrong.
Sure.
You gentlemen could not have been more wrong about this. And just the scene where he's in that little theater being shown off and he transforms.
While no one says anything?
Well,
the head doctor has his back to him as he's transforming. There's an audience of people watching him turn into a wolf.
So
and the guy has his right.
All we get is
and
loud.
And no one says, hey, turn
yeah.
around. He's turning into a fucking wolf.
All we get is loud, indistinct
right.
murmurs,
right.
not the entire
right.
congregation of doctors screaming as right. one, shut up and turn around.
Right. That doesn't work. That makes no sense, and that bothers me. I'm
or
able
maybe
to suspend disbelief
just,
to a point.
Right,
but.
That maybe this is just the filmmakers, and a lot of directors do this successfully. They know that the characters on screen can't hear us. That's what we would shout, but that's why they're denying it on the screen to establish suspense and tension. Why doesn't he turn around?
But it's idiotic.
And no,
it's,
it is.
It's just so we can get the beat where he turns around and realizes he's wrong and his eyes bulge and, oh, holy shit. Which could have been just as successful if Lawrence started changing right in front of him as he washed and that realization comes across his face. I realize that would require
well,
more subtle
I would,
acting.
I would prefer that because what you just said brings to mind There was a long period of time where in class I showed the film Night of the Living Dead. And in a famous story that I now tell all my classes, there's a scene at the beginning of the film when a woman is very panicked. She's seen her brother killed, is running away from this threat, and she's running in a grassy cemetery, and she falls down. Mm-hmm. She falls down and loses a shoe, but she gets up and she keeps running. Now, maybe it's just because I've been on this planet for a number of years. Often, if you are very frightened and you're running, you might fall because human beings fall.
Right.
And my guess is the screenwriters and director George Romero had her fall because, of course, this isn't a documentary. She didn't really fall. Mm-hmm. It was in the script that she should fall.
Back up. This is not a documentary?
It's not a documentary, believe it or not. That they have her fall so that the people in the audience who are also human beings and who perhaps have fallen at one time or another will say, oh, that's incredibly unfortunate, but I would like that character to live because she's human, right, as opposed to the zombie who's chasing her. And she gets up, and we have a brief moment of suspense and tension. Oh, thank God she got up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I showed this film to a group of teenagers a number of years ago, and for the first time, I got the following reaction, which floored me. We're watching the film. She is running away from the zombie. She falls down and loses the shoe. And out loud, one of the kids in class shouts, "Stupid!" And not only
that is pretty stupid, though, when a zombie's chasing you.
Patrick is being ironic. Not only shouldn't you shout things during a film, especially not in a film study class, but it shows that to the student in question, he is so sure that if he were in the same situation, he would not make that mistake. So is he watching this as an instructional survival documentary? Or does he just sit there because he wants to feel superior to the people on the screen? Or is he siding with the zombie? Now back to the asylum.
Yeah.
I think what we see in the asylum is exactly the opposite. That in trying to engender this fake suspense, it becomes impossible for us to side with that character for any number of reasons. And there's a big difference between this hellacious thing going on behind you and you not hearing it and not turning it around and someone running as fast as they can and falling down.
Right.
It's honest suspense and suspension of disbelief versus movie land, boy. It would be great if he'd turn around, wouldn't it? But I'm not going to have him turn around.
I think you're absolutely right about that kid feeling superior to that in Night of the Living Dead. And I think that's what happens a lot, unfortunately, with younger people watching older movies. Or that's the only emotion they have, is that they feel superior to this because it was made before their time.
Whenever I attend Ebertfest, one of the highlights is always a silent film that's accompanied by the Alloy Orchestra. And almost every year, there's this wave, occasionally, of superior laughter that speaks, oh, weren't things quaint back then?
Right.
But sometimes it's misplaced, because one year he showed The Black Pirate, a Douglas Fairbanks film, that clearly knew...
It's in color.
Well, two-strip Technicolor. That film clearly knows what it's doing and has its tongue firmly in its cheek.
Right.
So people were reacting ironically to something that wasn't ironic at all.
Right.
No, the film knows it's being silly.
Right.
Oh, weren't they silly? Well, yeah. So you agree with the film.
Right.
So
aren't you smart? You're
showing, you're mocking the film for agreeing with it.
So the problem I have with the asylum scene is that that moment that we're talking about, its only function is to make us feel superior to that doctor.
Well, and then at that point, the suspense becomes, you know he's going to get it.
Right.
So they're holding off on showing you him getting it.
But that's another one of those beats then, spoiler for what happens to the doctor. He gets thrown out a window and impaled on a wrought iron fence, and that's another one of those beats that feels unnecessary. I know he has to get it. I know it should be probably a little more mean-spirited because he was wrong, but I think that it pushes it a little far.
And I don't like Out the Window, and I don't like Impaled on the Fence. But the one thing I did like is, as all of the other doctors are rivering out of the asylum, mm-hmm. we get a nice shot of Hugo Weaving looking at the doctor impaled on the fence, mm-hmm. and knowing what we know about the end of the film, a nice little bit of subtle foreshadowing. Yeah. Hey, Hugo.
Right.
Take a good look.
Right. And his reaction, actually, he watches that happen in the theater too, right? And his reaction is the one I'm talking about. That's what the doctor should be having.
Oh, yeah.
That's what the doctor should, but we see it on Hugo Weaving. So I guess good, it's in there, but...
It was in Hugo's contract. I get to have the good reaction right. to the transformation scene.
I just get angry when Roger Ebert, when he was reviewing, I think, Die Hard, this always sticks out to me, he hated the Paul Gleason character and knocked the movie down a couple of stars, because Die Hard, by the way, is awesome. Knocked the movie down a couple of stars because he says, there's this character in the movie whose only function is to be wrong. And that's... this doctor, that's his only function is to be smug and wrong.
True, but I actually think in that sense the Paul Gleason character works better than the doctor and the Wolfman, in that all of us know people like the Paul Gleason character,
right?
And they exist. And by the way, you're absolutely right. Not only was Die Hard, the first one, the template
yeah.
for 20 years of action films, but that movie is amazing and endlessly rewatchable.
Yep. Yeah. Where do you place the Wolfman in the pantheon of werewolf movies?
Well, by the time Universal got around to making the Wolfman, because they gave it a go in the early 30s with The Werewolf of London, which is a very different film yeah. for a number of reasons. So they dust off the Wolfman and they do the Wolfman. The story goes that Jack Pierce had designed the makeup we see on Lon Chaney for Henry Hull, who for many reasons didn't want to wear it and insisted they come up with the...
Eddie Munster look?
Well, it's much less like a wolf.
Right.
That because the Wolfman was made so late in the cycle, and now we see World War II looming... The Wolfman doesn't get a chance to have quite as many interesting sequels. They immediately start shoving him into these monster rallies right. of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula. So he doesn't really get a moment in the sun quite like Frankenstein and Dracula. And those films are interesting, but they're not very good. Off the top of my head... I would put this in the top 10.
Okay.
Of Wolfman films ever made. I mean, I would put it in the top 10.
Many.
It's not as if there's hundreds.
Right.
But
Original Wolfman's the best.
I have a soft spot in my heart for that, although one can make an argument that American Werewolf in London
yeah.
is an amazing film that just keeps getting better every year.
I would have to say that's my favorite.
And Curse of the Werewolf with Oliver Reed is very interesting, but
and that movie takes a long time to get where it's going.
Well, see, here's the thing, and this is the little short story I wanted to tell. When I was a child, ABC Television in Chicago had something called the 3:30 movie. And the 3:30 movie, as you might guess, started at 3:30, but it had to be over at 5 because that's when the news was on, and it was chock full of commercials. Mm-hmm. So the 3:30 movie was half a movie.
Right.
And so my early memory of watching Curse of the Werewolf is on the 3:30 movie where all of that interminable stuff at the beginning
that might be better
it was edited right out.
Werewolf, right?
She's put in the dungeon, he attacks yeah. her, and Oliver Reed transforms. Cut to commercial. Now here's Fahey Flynn with the news. They used to show beach party movies a lot.
Okay.
On the 3:30 movie, because, of course, it's really easy to take chunks out of right. those and not be missing anything. I agree that the Oliver Reed version takes a while to get going, but there's a lot to like in that film, especially Oliver Reed's performance. The Werewolf of London is not without its charms.
Yeah.
I'm old school, so I got to put the Lon Chaney film first, but it almost seemed at times that this film was a blueprint for a new attraction at Universal Studios, where they would, whenever I visit the theme park, it seems to me that they don't give enough credit to the original Universal monsters, not only because they've been popular for 80 years now,
right.
but originally kept them out of bankruptcy and right. kept the studio going, and that some sort of Wolfman Village attraction would be welcome. A couple years ago, they revamped the makeup show to include a tribute to Jack Pierce, which I thought was a wonderful thing to do.
Where would you place the Wolfman along the lines of, particularly, I guess, the classic horror movie remakes, which really were popular in sort of the mid-90s, and they never really did a proper Wolfman remake. They did Wolf. Mike Nichols did Wolf.
Right.
But they did Bram Stoker's Dracula and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and you knew that they were faithful because they had the author's names in the title. They even did Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Stephen Frears, Mary Riley, yeah. which is a terrible movie.
Yes, it is. I remember when Bram Stoker's Dracula came out on Criterion Collection Laserdisc.
Whoa.
That's how old I am. There were these making-of documentaries where Francis Ford Coppola was shown in home video footage forcing the cast to sit at a table, I think over 2 days, and read the novel out loud.
Really?
And considering the film that resulted, it made me wonder why he made them do this.
That they didn't show the scene at the end where he said, "Now stand on the table and tear it up."
That being said, I am a tremendous fan of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
That movie's crazy.
For all of its faults, right. and again, going back to what we liked about this version of the Wolfman, the way it looks yeah. is just,
yeah.
you know, I've talked to different classes endlessly about the fact that in the original Dracula, Dracula is evil. Dracula is the devil. Dracula is going to steal your soul. But luckily, we have Dr. Van Helsing who can save us. And interestingly enough, in the Coppola remake, that's reversed. Mm-hmm. Dracula is the romantic hero in the remake, and Van Helsing is crazy. So what is this telling us about ourselves? Not a fan of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and I almost don't consider it a horror film. The Mummy, the Brendan Fraser Mummy, is tremendously entertaining.
Yeah,
because
but not
someone,
really a horror movie.
Because someone said the way to remake this is to not make it a Universal horror film. It's right. to make it an Indiana Jones film.
Right.
And by God, they were right.
Right.
I would much rather have Indiana Jones meets the Mummy than having him meet a crystal skull. But that's just me. Imagine the Brendan Fraser Mummy with Indiana Jones,
yeah,
that's something. So, except for Bram Stoker's Dracula, of the remakes of the classic Universal films, I would place the Wolfman second.
Yeah, I guess I would too.
And I read
that's
somewhere
the other ones are kind of terrible.
I read somewhere that the creature's coming.
That's been coming for years and years. Michael Eisner's son, Breck Eisner, has been working on that for years and years, and every, you know, 6 months to a year, we hear it's going again, it's going again. And he had only made one movie, Sahara, which wasn't very good. But then he just did the remake of The Crazies, which is decent.
No, I enjoyed it.
So I think Creature from the Black Lagoon could be remade well. I mean, I think...
No, I think there's a way to do it.
Yeah.
One way would be to not use that attraction they came up with. And to be fair, I haven't seen it, but I've seen pieces of it on YouTube. I don't know if it's still playing. I think just in the California park, they had some sort of show that was Creature from the Black Lagoon that was a musical. And it was very campy, and it was very tongue-in-cheek. And the monster, meaning the Gill Man, had sort of Rastafarian dreadlocks.
There we go.
They reimagined him. And by reimagine, I mean ruin. And they had him sing. And it was sort of pitched as a family attraction, but from what I saw and what I read, a lot of the humor was sort of smutty. So they wound up pleasing no one.
Right. Wow. Well, there's paying tribute to the stars that saved your studio. Had the Wolfman been a success, do you think they would have continued remaking classic Universal horror movies?
Of course. Of course. I mean, this is a business enterprise, and God knows I want Universal to make as much money as they possibly can so they can put out spiffy special editions of all the films that I really like. Speaking of which, October, Psycho on Blu-ray with a couple new special features And
that movie comes out a lot.
I can't count. I think I've only ever purchased Singing in the Rain in more incarnations than Psycho. But again, for a plug, where's my brain? David Thompson just published a book called The Moment of Psycho, which is amazing and everyone should read it.
Oh, all right. There was one other thing about The Wolfman that I meant to say, and it's such a stupid point, but there's a few shots interspersed throughout the movie. It's a sort of a quick flash, and it almost feels like an insert shot of just the Wolfman makeup where he's about to bite somebody.
Yeah.
And it's a flash on him, whether it's a gunshot or, lightning. I don't know what causes the flash, but I assume it's intentional. In those shots, it looks very much like the Jack Pierce Wolfman. Hmm. Or did you not think that?
I know the shots you're talking about. I now wish I had frozen the frame.
Okay.
I don't know if that was intentional. I, just off the top of my head, I'm hoping that it is because, and I haven't sat down, I don't think the film would warrant this, but I haven't sat down and actually studied it, but there seems to be a couple other shout-outs to other classic horror films in this. So a couple shots that look like the Jack Pierce makeup, that would be delightful. And the original scene when Benicio comes home and greets his father on the steps mm-hmm. reminds me of that opening scene in Dracula. Visually, it's very, right, very right. similar. And, of course, one of the actors from American Werewolf in London shows up in this film as the Bobby, as the policeman in the pub, and later he's okay. ripped apart. That's the gentleman in American Werewolf in London in the pub, "You made me miss," who misses the dart right. shot when Griffin Dunn interrupts. So nice to see he's still getting work, right. but I thought... If you actually sat down and looked at the film through that lens, I'm guessing there's others.
Okay. Joe Johnson swears that that sequence near the end is not an homage to the whole Piccadilly Circus scene in American Werewolf, although to me it seemed...
Yeah, in fact, isn't there some sort of vehicle or...
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The minute I saw that, I said, right. nice.
Yeah, he swears that was not intentional. But again, who knows? He came out of the movie very late.
And directors lie.
All right, I guess that's all we have to say about the Wolfman. Thanks for doing this with me. You're smart.
You're welcome. And in closing, I just wanted to mention that the way you walked was thorny through no fault of your own. But as the river enters the sea, so too you will find peace. That's not word for word, but that's the little poem that Maliva says in the original.
Right. Here's mine. It's your funeral. this is F This Movie, and we'll see you guys soon.